Good morning. It's good to see everyone this morning. We do have visitors here with us. They're our honored guests. They're sitting with Doug and Debbie this morning. We'll be studying, as many of you know, in 1 Samuel. Today we're going to try to cover chapters 24 to 27 Wednesday night, chapters 28 to 31, as we do a survey of 1 Samuel. Grant intends to begin 2 Samuel on Sunday morning, and we should finish 2 Samuel at the end of March. As we begin our class today, let's do a very high-level brief review. In 1 Samuel, we've met Elkanah and Hannah, who were childless. Hannah so sincerely wanted a child, she prayed to God that if she had a son, she'd dedicate him to the Lord. Samuel was born, and a young Samuel was taken to Eli the priest to live with him in fulfillment of Hannah's vow. As time passed, he became a prophet and judge of Israel. Later, he anointed Saul king in accordance with God's instructions. In chapter 13, Saul had offered a burnt offering and made a rash vow. In chapter 15, he was rebuked for his presumptuous behavior and not killing all the Amalekites, man, woman, and child, as God had instructed, and God determined that there would be a different person anointed as king, and that was David. David killed Goliath and became quite popular, and that irritated Saul. As we see in about chapter 18, Jonathan and David were very, very close, closer than brothers, a relationship that is to be cherished if you have that. In chapter 19, David basically becomes a fugitive and flees because Saul seems to want to kill David. In chapter 20, David and Jonathan meet again. They're still very close. And then in our class on Wednesday night on chapters 21 to 23, we saw that David was going to great lengths to avoid Saul and escape death multiple times. We saw that Saul had tried to kill David using various methods. So David did not want to kill God's anointed. As we begin today, we're going to be in the 24th chapter. We're going to see David's third escape from Saul. They're in the wilderness of En-Gedi, near a place called the Rock of Goats, Rocks of the Wild Goats. And Saul and David will end up in a cave together, and there's going to be a temporary reconciliation. As we look at a map, En-Gedi is toward the southwestern area, next to the Dead Sea. As we look at verses 1 through 7 of the 24th chapter, first, let me go back to verse 2, or let me go forward to verse 2, and mention the rocks of the wild goats. The internet says there's about 500 known caves along the western shore of the Dead Sea. It's also interesting that in 1947, some goats were apparently misbehaving, and a young Bedouin shepherd boy through a rock that landed in a cave, and he heard a noise, a hollow sound. He decided to climb down into the cave and found three of the ancient Dead Sea Scrolls. And since then, hundreds more have been found. And while these scrolls are important because they verify the Bible's reliable, it's interesting that goats and sheep foals that are mentioned specifically here in verses 2 and 3, as being in the wilderness of this area, that there still was a presence of goats and sheep foals in the area in more modern times. So, looking directly at verses 1 to 7, Saul hears where David is. We're not told who told him, but he takes 3,000 men to go after David. There's a cave where David and his men are hiding. And Saul goes in to relieve himself. David's men urge him to attack Saul, saying, "Behold, I'm about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you." So David goes up to where Saul is and thoughtfully doesn't kill him, but cuts off the edge of Saul's robe and feels guilty and says, "Far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed. Because God had Samuel anoint Saul king, David keeps his men from attacking Saul and allows Saul to leave the cave unharmed. In verses 8 to 15, after Saul goes a safe distance, we see that David calls to Saul and he bows in humility toward Saul and says, "Why do you listen to the words of men, saying, 'Behold, David seeks to harm you'? Behold, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord has given you today into my hand in the cave, and some said to kill you. But my eye had pity on you, and I said, 'I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.'" David makes it clear he could have killed Saul. And the evidence of the fact is the edge of Saul's robe that David is holding. However, David did not kill Saul, the Lord's anointed. Instead, David strongly says, "I have not sinned against you," and calls on the Lord to judge between Saul and David to verify the truth of David's statement. David then says Saul was wasting his time to seek David, for David was no more of a threat to him than a flea is to a dead dog. David then calls on God to deliver him from the hand of Saul. As we go to verses 16 to 21, in the balance, what we're going to see here is that David finished speaking these words. Saul said, "Is this your voice?" And David acknowledges that it is his voice. So Saul says, "You are more righteous than I, for you have dealt well with me. I have dealt wickedly with you. You have declared today that you have gone, that you have done good to me, that the Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me." Now, that's pretty thoughtful, I think. So, as we look at this passage, Saul says, "May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you have done to me this day. I know that you will surely be king." And all that Saul asked, basically, is an oath from David not to wipe out his family when David becomes king. So David does give the oath, and Saul goes home, and David and his men return to their stronghold. Interesting passage to this point. What are your comments through this point? In the 25th chapter, we're going to begin and see that then Samuel died. Things are changing. David's on the run. I like that expression. Grant used it many times Wednesday night. David is on the run. And we're going to meet Abigail, an intelligent and beautiful woman. To begin, again, we see that Samuel is dead, and we see out of people's respect for Samuel and his work as a judge and as a prophet, all the people of Israel gather to mourn Samuel, who was buried in his house at Ramah, which, you know, is north of Jerusalem. And I put there at the bottom of the screen an indicator of what 4 miles would be. And as we've said before, distances in Israel are not all that great because the size of the country is not all that great. So as we look at the balance of verse 1, we see that after Samuel's death, David stayed on the move. He went about 100 miles south to the wilderness of Paran on the border between Canaan and the Sinai Peninsula. As we think about that area, this slide also gives you some indication of that general area. At the top on your left, you see the Dead Sea and a larger area there on the right. But then go down toward the south, and you can see a good distance has been covered by David to get away from Saul, to try not to have any problems with Saul. David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. So we come to verses 2 and 3 of the 25th chapter. It says, "Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. Had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats, and it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel." Now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail, and the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. As we look at this, this man is a rich descendant of Caleb. He's named Nabal. Nabal. It's a word which means fool. Seems rather appropriate. He was wealthy, had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. He was married to an intelligent and beautiful wife like I am and like many of you men. His character, though, was harsh. It was evil. That's what it says. The man was harsh and evil in his dealings. While his home is in Maon, you see that Carmel is just a short distance away, and he had business there. So as we look at verses 4 through 8, David hears that this man is shearing sheep and sends 10 of his young men to Carmel to greet him nicely by wishing him well and noting that they have been respectful toward his shepherds and have not taken any of his livestock. They haven't been thieves at all. Potentially, even I would say the presence of David's men may have protected Nabal's flocks from thieves and raiders. David's men arrive on a happy day of celebration. It says there in verse 4, on a festive day, when you would think that this man, Nabal, would be inclined to generosity. And they ask for a donation of some needed supplies. Well, he lives up to his reputation. In verse 9, when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all the words in David's name. Then they waited. And I went one slide too many. Let me back up to 14. David sent his men. He even told them what to say. He told them to be very thoughtful in how they approached him. So, in verse 8, ask your young men and they will tell you that nothing is missing, that we've been good neighbors, if you will. So in verse 9, when David's young men came, they spoke to this man all the words that David had told them to say. And then as you look at these verses, look at verse 10. But Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who's David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I do not know?" Now that's rude. He's not respectful toward David at all. Who is David? Who is this son of Jesse? In fact, he doesn't consider David and his men worthy of any help. You know, he's questioning the heritage of David. And then he basically says, "You're just unworthy servants that have left your master." So in verses 12 to 13, this continues. David's men return and tell David what has occurred. To say David is not happy is an understatement. David is furious. He orders his men in verse 12 to prepare for action and takes 400 of his men with him and leaves 200 behind. And they go to deal with Nabal. In verse 14, as David prepares for battle, one of Nabal's men tell Abigail about Nabal's poor treatment of David and his men. They also tell her that David's men have protected them day and night, and now her husband has been rude and scornful toward David and his men. Nabal's men sum things up real nicely there at the end of verse 17. He is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. He's worthless. He won't listen to advice, even when it's good advice. And they know that David's on the way. Oh, I jumped two slides. Verse 18. In response to a very bad situation, Abigail takes matters into her own hands. And without telling her husband, she loads donkeys with 200 loaves of bread and 2 jugs of wine, 5 prepared sheep, 5 measures of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisin, 200 cakes of figs, and tells the young men, "Go on before me." Verses 21 and 22 clearly say that David is angry. He intends to kill every male. If by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him, may God do so to the enemies of David and more also. He's not going to leave any of these people alive. Abigail follows her men on the donkey. David and his men are traveling toward Nabal's home with the clear intent of killing quite a few people. So as we get to verse 23, Abigail meets David and gets off her donkey and bows to the ground. While without guilt herself, what does she do? She takes full responsibility for Nabal's lack of hospitality and rudeness toward David's 10 messengers by saying she didn't get to meet with the men. She urges David to not pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal. Obviously, she knows her husband's nature like most women know their husband's nature. And she knows her husband's is worthless. "Please do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man." In verse 26, Abigail made about 3 points. She says, first, through her actions, God has kept David and his men from killing a lot of people. Secondly, she wishes that all David's enemies will be fools like her husband. And then third, she hopes the gift of food she has brought to David will be accepted and given to his men. In verse 28, she says, "Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant." For first, she says that David will be greatly blessed by God with an enduring house, that is, a long-lasting line of descendants. Secondly, in verse 29, Abigail says God will protect David's life when his enemies seek him. And then third, the Lord will cast his enemies away like a stone being thrown from a sling. And we've talked about David and his sling and how accurate some people could be with him and the force with which it could work. So Abigail has tried to make amends. She's bowed humbly before David. She's brought him a great number of gifts. She's tried to be extremely thoughtful. And as we look at these verses, in the next verses, David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord of God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your discernment who have kept me this day from bloodshed." So David received the gifts from her hand. And encouraged her to go up to her house within peace. He knows that there in verse 34, surely there would not have been left an able until the morning light as much as one male. David knew what he intended to do, and it's only through Abigail's intervention that he does not act so forcefully. A lot of people would have died. He's thankful of the gifts Abigail brings. He's granted her request for forgiveness. She can return home without fear. Any comments through this point? And I didn't hear which verse? Okay, 30. Well, I think we've already seen earlier that she's described as an intelligent woman, and your point's well taken. And her husband is certainly foolish in his behavior. Well said. So as we get down to verse 36, Abigail returns home to a drunk husband. The next morning she told him she kept him from being killed. And in verse 37, it says, his heart died within him, so they became as a stone. Now, you know I'm an accountant, not a physician, but that sounds like a heart attack or a stroke, something serious. And 10 days later, it says, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. So that's the end of him. As we go to verse 39, when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and has kept back his servant from evil. As we look at verses 39 to 42, we see that David is going to send an invitation to Abigail to be his wife. He's thankful that God kept him from killing so many, but he wants to provide for the wife. She immediately accepts the invitation. She quickly arises, gathers her staff, her five maidens who attend her, and she follows the messengers back to become David's wife. In verses 43 and 44, David had also taken Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they both became his wives. Now Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. As you think about David, and you look at these verses, we see Michal was taken away from David by Saul, but David has Ahinoam and Abigail as his wives. On the other side of the screen, side of the slide, you'll see that later in life, David did have other wives other than just these ladies. Any comments through the 25th chapter? In the 26th chapter, the first five verses, we're going to see the fifth episode whereby David escapes Saul's efforts to kill him. These Ziphites, if that's how it's pronounced, have already betrayed David earlier, which we saw in chapter 23. They've told Saul about David. David is once again trying to escape from Saul. David is in the southwest part of Judah, described by commentators as a small district in the desert of Judah. Since 1 Samuel 11 and 8 and 2 Samuel 24, 9 indicate that Israel could raise a very huge army of hundreds of thousands, the fact that it says here in verse 2, Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having with him 3,000 chosen men, of Israel to search for David. I think that indicates that he's maintaining a standing army for his protection and for his use. As we look at verses 6 through 12, realizing that Saul is after him again, David's on the run, Saul is camped nearby, and he's surrounded by his troops. David determines that he's going to go down into the camp during the night and ask if there's somebody that will go with him. And, I'll mispronounce it, Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So that's what they do. They go down to the camp. It's in the dark of night. They find Saul asleep with Abner and others around him. Abishai wants to kill Saul. As you look there, he says, "Today," in verse 8, "today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now therefore, please let me strike him with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him the second time." He's going to do it right on the first effort. David disagrees because he believes it would not be proper to do this to the Lord's anointed. Instead, David thinks that Saul should die a natural death or death from God or die in battle. Instead of striking Saul, David takes his spear and his water jug and escapes undetected because God... Look at verse 12. "So David took the spear and the jug of water from beside Saul's head, and they went away, but no one saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them." God helped David out here. As you go to verse 13, from a distance, David shouts and tries to wake everyone up. Wants Saul to be awake. Wants the camp to be awake. He pointedly calls out Abner's name. David called to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer Abner?" And as you hear David do that, Abner was a relative of Saul and commander of Saul's troops. David accuses in this passage Abner and the men with not protecting King Saul, and says they deserve to die for their failure to do their duty. David is bluntly saying there, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came to destroy the king your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die because you did not guard your Lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear and the jug of water that was at his head." I guess Abner is saying, "What are you talking about?" And David says, "Here's the proof that you did not guard the king. Here's the spear and here's the jug of water." In verse 17, we see that Saul recognized David's voice. "Is this your voice, my son David?" David said, "It is my voice, my lord the king." So as we look at this, David says, if God if God had caused Saul to chase David, that would be one thing. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. If God has sent you after me, let's make an offering and settle things. If it is men trying to drive David away from God, let them be accursed. If it is men, cursed are they before the Lord, for they've driven me out today. David in verse 20 says, he does not want to die on foreign soil because David is like a single flea, just as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. In other words, David says, I'm not worth your effort, Saul. You need to quit chasing after me. In verse 21, Saul said, I have sinned. David's words touched Saul's heart. I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you again because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error. When Saul says, I have played the fool, he summarizes his life quite well. When we first met Saul back in chapter 9, he was humble. And we've discussed that here in class. Since then, we've seen him be a willful king who ignores God's instructions about the Amalekites, offers a burnt offering, though he's not a priest, issues a rash vow that hurts his own soldiers, and tries multiple times to kill David, and even tries to kill his own son. David invites one of Saul's servants to come and fetch the royal spear. David says he's confident that God would reward his righteousness and faithfulness in not killing King Saul. Saul responds by pronouncing a blessing on David, expresses confidence that David will be successful. Then they part, they go their separate ways, and they're never going to see each other again. At this point, one more time, let's look at the chart. The young David has conquered Goliath. We've seen David be a godly man and worthy of the respect of others. It appears to me that out of jealousy, Saul mistakenly treated David as his enemy and tried numerous times to kill him. Over the last four chapters, we've seen at least five occasions of Saul tracking David to try to kill him. We've seen David escape Saul five times. And now we're going to see David go the extra step to avoid Saul. David will go to the land of the Philistines to avoid Saul trying to kill him again. In chapter 27, first, any comments over 26? In chapter 27, then David said to himself, now I'll perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair of searching for me anymore in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand. For years, David has experienced Saul's efforts to kill him. He was tired. He was discouraged from being constantly on the run. He was confident that one day Saul was going to win and actually kill him. So he's got to do something to try to stop this. In verse 1, David does that. He takes his wives and his 600 men and their families and goes to Gath, and where he and his men seek political asylum, if you will. They're Israelites going into a Philistine land, and they've not been known to be friendly toward the traditional enemy. They place themselves under the authority of Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. Perhaps he was well received because he and his 600 men would be a great help in case the area was attacked, and because the Philistines understood that Saul considered David and his men as enemies. Maybe in this case, the Philistines viewed it as the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Verse 4 tells us David is right in thinking Saul would quit searching for him now that David and his men are in the land of the Philistines. In verses 5 to 7, after living in the area for a period of time, David's proven himself trustworthy. So in verse 5, he asks Achish to allow David and his men to take over one of the cities under Achish's control, and this would remove David and his men from the pagan influences of the Philistines, for sure, and their culture. And Achish is going to gain a trusted ally a little bit of distance away, and that can still be relied on to help protect that area of Philistia from attack. So Achish gives Ziklag to David, and it remained a possession of the kings of Judah at the time the book of 1 Samuel was written. Ziklag was a town given to the tribe of Simeon, initially in Joshua 19, verse 5. It was located 15 miles northwest of Beersheba and 25 miles south of Gath. The gift of Ziklag suggests the city was under Philistine jurisdiction. And as you see in verse 7, David lived in the country of the Philistines a year and 4 months. So, in the final part of the 27th chapter, while living in Ziklag, David and his men raided the Geshurites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites and even went west along the route to Shur toward the land of Egypt. David and his men left no witnesses to their actions. This allowed them to eliminate enemies of Israel who lived in the south and the west, and he was able to supply the needs of his followers. When Achish asked what David did, he would mislead Achish and respond that he had fought the people of the Negev of Judah, which was a dry area between the mountains of Judah and the desert of Arabia to the south and west. He had fought the Jerahmeelites and the Kenites of the area. You might remember that the Kenites had been associated with Israel since the days of Moses. From Achish's view, David was alienating himself from his homeland, from Israel, from the people of Israel. While what David was actually doing, as you read this passage, was he was sharing some of what he captured with the people in Israel, taking the goods and livestock to supply his own needs and sharing it with others. David did what David had to do to keep himself and his people safe. His actions made Achish confident that David was loyal to him and the Philistine cause. Achish was prepared to consider David and his men so loyal that very soon we're going to see that he's willing for them to be his personal bodyguard. What would you like to say, chapters 24 to 27? Then we'll look at chapters 28 through 31 on Sunday. Would you please read that passage before, on Wednesday, would you please read those passages? Chapter 28 is very interesting, as is the rest through 31. Thank you.